Well, it sounds like you've had a very energetic time. We've had a good time. We're now going to look at the questions that came across the transom. Believe it or not, there are over 200. I'd say the one thing that characterizes the questions is the level of sophistication. It's quite surprising. Everybody, you know, is connected to this issue at some level, and whether it's very close at hand, like turn up the heat, or very sophisticated in terms of, you know, how to trade carbon. So we'd like to take some of the questions that we have, that we've received, and then bat them around up here. And so we'll start with the first question and then just move sort of seamlessly through from there. The vast majority of buildings are older buildings. What steps can be taken to make them more energy efficient, if not carbon neutral? And Carlton, I think we're going to ask you to pick that up.
Well, I think, you know, that question is a really good question because it stands right in front of you. In New York City, where most of our work has been, the buildings are all old. The vast majority of buildings are old. But the sort of unique thing you need to understand about older cities, they're always changing. The city is a dynamic process, and it's not static at all. So if you take an office building, in New York City, every partition in an office building is changed on an average of every 5 years because new tenants move in, new organizations come in. Every mechanical system, someplace between 15 and 20 years, is replaced. So by making incremental changes and making things better as you go, over the course of a 25, 30-year period, you can have a huge impact. It's not necessarily a need to say, I'm going to take an old building and change everything now. But as systems become obsolete and are replaced, that's the opportunity to make changes where you can move toward more carbon neutral and certainly much more energy efficiency. Come on.
I'd like to address two questions that you've raised. At which point in the building cycle is most critical to infuse green building concepts? And do we have trained architects, engineers, carpenters to fully deploy in building green buildings? Architects don't make green buildings. It is a good architect, it's a great client, it is a fantastic supply chain that make green buildings. So the way you have to design a green building is quite different from what you design an ordinary building. And I would like to recommend the idea of a charrette. And a charrette is a process in which you get all the stakeholders into the room. So what we've started doing is taking a room about half the size of this room and getting the client, all our consultants, all the vendors into the room right from the beginning in the design of the building. So in the case that I say I want to have a lawn, then Maria will say, but you know, you need that much water. And then Carlton will say, but you know, we've got to pump this water. And someone is going to tell us how much it costs to pump. And then finally the answer is, look, I don't think we can have this lawn. what about something else? So the idea of a design charrette, it's a collaborative. It is not a single, it's not a single decision. We have gone down the supply chain. I think one of the sub-questions is that do buildings cost more? In India, they did cost, when I did the first building, 18% more. They're down now to 2%. In the United States, I believe there are 5 green buildings which haven't cost any additional amount. Do we have architects? LEED has got what they call a program for training LEED certified professionals. There are over 98,000 in the United States, or some 42,000. They're about over 1,000 in India. So the answer is yes, it is possible to approach an architect to look at green. I just want to add one more thing, and that is on this issue of retrofit. We've just done a bank for the ABN AMRO in a building which is not green, and I hope in Chicago next month we will be the first in the world to win a platinum for that building. So, yes, it is possible to turn around a non-green building into a green space. Stephen.
Yeah, something on city bank. A couple of things on how do you get this your existing buildings green? One is to bake it into the planning cycle, right? Your capital planning cycle. and begin to look at the life cycle cost as opposed to the initial cost. And it's a little bit about educating your project managers, right, not to just live by on time, on budget, and take the short-term view, but take the longer-term view. And I think that's one way to move this forward. The data center in Germany I talked about, that's a platinum data center. Everybody walked in the room, the engineers, the contractors, with the notion that we were going to do LEED silver and do it to a budget. And the very important point is that we did actually stick within our development budget and were able to achieve the goal level because we challenged each other. We said, you know, what can we do different, better, faster, cheaper? And you had a lot of bright minds thinking about this. And to your point, the more integration you get up front, the better result is likely to happen. One of the questions that is on here is, do financial and lending institutions like Citi take carbon footprint involved in their lending decisions? And I will tell you, on the larger projects, the bigger projects, the answer is yes. On the smaller projects, one of the structural problems that we have is that the appraisal institute yet doesn't quite know how to value carbon. And right, so they do equations on loan to value, right? And so the valuation of carbon is not quite where it needs to be. I think once we get a carbon cap and trade in place, and the general wisdom is that in the United States in the next, 2 years to 4 years, you all may have opinions, is that we'll see some form of that. And I think once that gets established, then it will be absolutely baked in. So the answer is yes, and it's evolving, and it's getting better, but it's not where it needs to be.
I think I might jump in on a couple of questions which were really around the barriers that face developers all around the world. So the regulatory barriers that prevent otherwise profitable deployment of green building concepts. So the first of all, we've addressed that you must have the right design team, the aligned client, but you really also need aligned government. So the regulatory barriers are that for those that don't understand the industry, the property industry, most of us are borrowing other people's money, institutional investors, to put into a property development. And then comes along the developer who's playing with other people's money to make it happen, working with governments to get the approvals and consent. And then you go into the design review, which actually comes up with the innovation to apply, and then you pass it off to the construction industry that builds it and then goes down into the contractor, subcontractor, and tiers of delivery to actually ensure the product is met. And then you've got a whole nother team that comes in and becomes the asset managers and a whole new set of people that occupy the building. And that is a whole bunch of people that are very rarely well aligned. So the regulatory barriers are around facilitating incentives, celebration, and motivation of green building movement. There are so many things happening in the US around fiscal incentives that the world is learning from. There are leading mayors, and you all know them in your various parts of the country, that actually give incentives and celebrate green buildings. So that's the first step in overcoming regulatory barriers, by giving a clear signal of certainty that green is good. In addition to that, we've got large parcels of land happening all around the world where the actual utilities are working with the developers to end up with better, smarter solutions. So I think the supply chain is actually working also, instead of being right down the bottom of the food chain, working higher. So the regulatory barriers that often prevent actually can come together and be a very powerful link. The federal government here announced probably a month ago that all federal buildings had to meet the green building criteria for the US, which is called Leadership in Energy, Environmental Design, and we've all been abbreviating it as LEED. So they said that they want it goes silver, gold, platinum in the kind of ranking. The federal government wants silver buildings. It's a shame it's not federal government wants platinum buildings, because you would have got some breakthrough technology with that.
Yeah. Just another point that Karen made. There's the issue of barriers, and architects and engineers being trained is one barrier, but people always ask about the workforce, because ultimately the work gets done by subcontractors and workers in that workforce. And one of the great challenges, one of the great opportunities is that the Apollo Alliance has recognized this as a huge opportunity to grow the economy and train a workforce in a new green economy. So as the economy, as architects and owners shift to a new way of designing and building, we believe that it will create jobs and job opportunities in sectors of the economy that never existed before. And there's this sort of trickle-up theory where it will actually grow the economy instead of shrinking the economy by creating these new opportunities. And I think if you look at any economy in any country, if you look at change as an opportunity to grow the economy, you'll see that there are a lot of opportunities that can make us better by actually improving our environmental impact.
I'd just like to comment on this a little bit. The city of San Francisco, city of Chicago have expedited real estate permit processes if you're doing a green building. These are the kinds of initiatives that you'll see coming out. But it also, you know, brings up this question of education and architects and being able to supply the marketplace and the marketplace being able to deal with these kinds of buildings. And so looking at those two points, the issue on supply, you know, there's a famous joke that architects are people who know more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing. And engineers are people who know, you know, less and less about more and more until they know everything about nothing about everything. And contractors know nothing about anything thanks to their contract with architects and engineers. But what you find out is that the movement in the architectural education community is huge. And to give you a sense of just the industrial design of the products that we're talking about on protocols, we're looking at standards for products developed around ecological intelligence. And there are 4,000 students of industrial design in the United States. Do you know how many there are in China? 200,000. There are 200,000 students of industrial design in China getting ready to come out with a design protocol and statements about what it means to be designed in China. And imagine the ability to communicate with all of them around things like this using some of the tools that we have today. If we look at what we could do using Google and using YouTube and so on and so forth and being able to communicate with designers on fundamental protocols, it's phenomenal convergence for education of this critical issue. So let's take a look at some of the other questions here. And by the way, I should note, we've been given more time. I think they need a little more time on the back end, so there's a little more time that's been given here. I'd like someone on the panel to take up the question of the proper role of utilities in advancing green buildings. Has anyone here had experience with utilities or concern about the utilities in terms of how we move green buildings forward?
I might jump into that. There's a project in Melbourne in Australia, and it's the first commercial office building in the country to mine the sewer, treat the water, and reuse it. It is the local authority's building. It's Melbourne City Council's office. And the reason that they could mine the sewer, treat it, and reuse it, not only for that building, the block of buildings, but all the trucks that the city uses for washdown, that's what they're generating out of one building mining a sewer. The only reason they could do it is that they are the consent authority. No developer in Australia can replicate that, and we're in the thick of a drought. So that is a utility that, you know, should be working with developers because clearly the technology exists. There's a project in Canada called Dockside Green, and that is a very, very unique green project. There's a website with lots of information, but the developer there, Joe Van Bellingham, who's on the board of the US Green Building Council, established the Canadian Green Building Council, is working with utilities so that he's getting the sewer water for free. He's treated the water, and he has created canals in this urban infill development where the lower apartments, they never sell first. They are the premium real estate because there's a beautiful water body that he has created out of the capturing and treatment of water on site. So it's those kind of unique partnerships. I'm deviating because a lot of the questions were saying, what about water? And when I come here and have a 16-litre flush toilet, that's outrageous, people. At home, we have dual flush. Caroma produces a 3- and 6-litre flush. And I just have to tell you, it works.
Can I just add to this issue,
sure,
of utilities? We've done a building in Bangalore, the Institute of Quality, And we have taken the concept of a wind tower. We spray our water, catch wind at 40 feet above the building. It becomes heavy, it falls, it loses heat to the wind tower. And we have been able to achieve 11 degrees Celsius reduction. It is an office building which is not air-conditioned, no utility. In another building, which we've done for the tribals, we've, like I said to you, we've used the idea of a screen. It's called the Venturi effect. You take hot air, pass it through a small opening, and it expands. It cools, passive cooling. So at, we must go back to some of these systems, and then we can not be looking at less utilities, but in some cases, no utilities.
In the U.S., you know, there are challenges, right? Because by and large, utilities haven't really been completely decoupled. You know, when I say decoupled, there's generation and there's transmission. And the argument that utility companies will make is if you don't, if I allow you to put energy back into the grid, I can't pay my costs for maintaining the transmission infrastructure. The truth of the matter is when we look at technologies like fuel cells, micro turbines, et cetera, the cost of generating energy on a distributed basis is actually economical because I can recover the heat, I can do chilling with that, I can heat hot water. But there will be times when I'm not operating at peak load when I will have excess energy. If I could put that energy back into the grid at the same cost they are charging me, it would be a break even or make a profit off of this, right? But because most utilities have not accepted that decoupled nature of it, in commercial buildings, you just can't make it work. There has to be some legislative effort to push that because the technological means for doing this are here and the economic means are here for doing it. But the regulatory environment, by and large, with a few exceptions, does not really permit us to take advantage of what technology now offers.
And if you believe there's a sense of urgency, and there is, the cumbersome nature of getting those large power plants approved and online, I think corporations are a little bit more nimble, right, and could figure this out and make a more immediate impact. So circling that as an issue, I think, is a very important one and well stated by Carl.
I just want a show of hands of who's cold in the room. Okay, so I work in a building that uses technology that's 30 years old. It is the kind of cold water that you wash your hands with in the restrooms. It is piped through the ceiling, little pipes that run in the ceiling. And what happens is that it's just old physics. Hot air rises from your bodies, from the lighting, from computers. It actually falls around the pipes in the ceiling. It cools and cool air falls. Now, I'm not good on the Fahrenheit Celsius, but in Sydney we had 44 degrees Celsius. That's kind of 100, pretty close, if not more. Okay, so more. Great. Hot day. Hot day in Sydney. It was 24 degrees in our office building on that day, which is more comfortable than this room. It is 85% more efficient. But the best thing is you're only getting 10% fresh air in this room, and it's been recirculated in this hotel all week. In our building, it's 100% fresh air, and we don't need coffee and chocolate at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
We designed a building in California where the Wall Street Journal decided to put it on the front page with the headline, Windows That Open, Latest Office Amenity. And we told the reporter that we reached a low point in Western civilization when a window that opens is news. David, I think you've got our themes for us.
I do. Thank you. Hey, everybody. So there were a record 340 themes that went back to the theme team here. And one of our themers, Ken Novak, had an interesting insight, which is our first problem here is our first question is about problem. What's the problem? Which is the only time we've done that over the course of 3 days. Every other question we've asked is, what's the solution? And he noted the answer to the question, what's the problem, was flooding back much quicker than the answer to the question, what's the solution? So, interesting insight there. We also had, from the table, I understand, prompted by this conversation, a $50,000 contribution from the Epstein Family Foundation for work on green buildings with partners they were talking with at the table. So, bravo. the Fantastic Foundation. Many thanks for that spontaneous leadership. So we got a lot of answers to the question, what's the problem? I'll run through some of them quickly. Awareness and education is probably the thing that we got as much as anything. People need to know what works. Lack of smart meters, so people don't understand their energy usage in homes and in offices. The expense was discussed a lot. High upfront costs for new buildings, even higher costs for retrofitting. Somebody made an interesting point about the fear of unknown costs. Owners can't get their money back when the property is sold, and tenants stay 5 years and the benefits last 20, which really rolls into a broader point about principal-agent problems in the real estate industry, where you've got contractors and owners and tenants in some cases with very different incentives affecting our ability to do green building. Number of points about labor skills, not enough green architects and not enough skilled labor in communities. Points about habits. Few people ask for green buildings. There are few codes in place. We need the utilities to get involved. No regulatory framework, no price on carbon. Wouldn't have wanted to do a session without that coming back in large quantity. It's not being promoted by mayors in sufficient amount was a final point. So we got lots of great ideas for CGI commitments. I'm going to read a few of them here. Again, we've captured them, and we're going to try to disseminate them in other ways as well, perhaps posting them on our website. A suggestion that each CGI member should commit to survey energy use in their buildings and reduce energy use 2 times by 2015. A suggestion that if they can do it in the UK, we can do it here. CGI members commit that all new buildings built or purchased will be carbon neutral by 2016. Creating toolkits for homeowners and home builders to go green, funding a mass media campaign, Consumer Reports could put out a special issue on green buildings. And here's one I thought was interesting. Create a one-stop turnkey operation that assesses retrofitting possibilities and offers finance and contractors to do the work. That is, if you want to make your home green right now and you don't know the first thing about architecture, what do? Who do you turn to? And there aren't enough just simple one-stop turnkey operations out there. Somebody proposed a joint utility building developer commitment to build green and increase energy efficiency. That struck us because that is somewhat similar to what the group of utility company CEOs on stage announced yesterday with the president, and anybody who's interested in that might seek out some of those utilities who are already moving in that direction for partnership. Somebody suggested creating a green collar job corps program, and we've got some of those represented here. I know Van Jones and Green for All, and there's some others, so you ought to seek out those people here. Professional sports leagues like the NHL or Major League Baseball could commit to going green, reaching millions of fans. Great idea. Here's a simple one that just takes money, supporting green engineering and architecture scholarships. creating an advocacy and legal defense fund to support green building efforts, to change building codes and educate on benefits. And here's a great one. Get a commitment from the Boy and Girl Scouts to give green merit badges for home energy audits and sell compact fluorescents instead of cookies. There's a lot of creativity in this room today. So in addition to that, Jim, one that we like, somebody asked, why are people willing to pay for Italian marble but not for efficiency? Abandoned neckties so that we can make the place warmer. I love that. Four words, Bill McDonough TV show. And here's one that is becoming a recurring theme, hold the next CGI in a green building. Thank you, and I'll turn it back over to Bill to continue the program.
Okay, well, we have 15 minutes more, so I think we'll continue our dialogue. Maria, do you have something you'd like to?
Yeah, there was start? Out of the 200, Bill, there was one question that said Lendlease commits to funding the establishment of green building councils to promote standards in developing countries. that do not have such associations at present. So I'm very happy to say that the Lendlease Board signed off last week in Singapore amongst many sustainability aspirations, that that was a key one, that we're committed to being part of the founding members of Green Building Councils around the world in all countries in which we operate.
What other commitments did we hear, types of commitments that we think would be of great value? You liked all of them? Great. Okay. Then I think this issue of each CGI member commits to survey energy use in existing buildings and reduce energy use by 2 times in 2015 begs the question of taking this kind of enthusiasm home with you and acting it out in your life. And I think if I could take a few of these minutes just to ask everyone to think both about energy but also about mass. From a design perspective, the Earth is powered by nuclear fusion. We have a reactor. It's 93 million miles away. It's 8 minutes, and it's wireless. What is the problem? So if we can get this energy, which is kinetic energy transferred to photons, here in 8 minutes, deployed intelligently, we will solve the energy problem because we have energy income. We have 5,000 times more energy striking the Earth's surface than humans will ever need. So we'll solve the energy problem because we have income. If we all went home tonight and you had 5,000 times more income than you needed, you solve your home economics. What happens is it strikes the Earth's mass, and that's inorganic chemistry. And the rocks and water are transformed by the sun into biology, which is us. And the Earth is meant to have growth. The problem is that in green building that we have to pay attention to, not just the energy, which has been the focus of this conversation and many others, but the quality of the mass. If we take all the chromium out of South Africa and then spread it and put it in little holes in the ground all around the world, and future generations will look back and say, what were you doing? You toxified the planet and you distributed the chromium so we can never recover it. We need a cradle-to-cradle protocol for materials as well as a CO2 protocol for energy. Because it's, as you know, Thoreau said, what's the good of a house if you don't have a tolerable planet to put it on? What's the good of an energy efficient? What's the good of an energy efficient house if it's poisoning you? So I would just like to add that as a personal note to the list. I think this idea of making commitments about taking inventories is really great, but I think also to get to the kinds of things that Karen was pointing out, we have to communicate with our supply chains up and down about the health and safety of things, as well as their energy component.
Yeah. The other thing, that one of the questions that appeared here in 25 different forms was the cost question, right? And I think, you know, everyone believes that green building absolutely must cost more because you're doing something different. Well, it costs more if you're doing what you've always done and tacked on something and call it green. And the thing that developers tend to do is, when you're developing real estate, by nature, it's a fairly risky business. And so a lot of firms believe that the way to manage risk is to do what you've always done. And so now someone says, make a green building. So the inherent nature is to do what you've always done and then tack something onto it and call it green. Well, what you've done is actually increased the cost. What I would want to say is that any architect or developer that has successfully developed a green building did something completely different from what they've always done. Their way of thinking about design was integrated, whether it was talking about starting with who the end user is and working with the design team, the architects, the engineers, in sort of real-time space on more of a matrix as opposed to a hierarchical way of doing it. Whether it's looking at the way you build, you know, do you use some of the processes that you can borrow from industrial thinking or industrial process engineering. And someone would say, well, does that lead me to modular housing? Well, the truth of the matter is, if you look at the sort of Dell experiment, where they said that you can do mass production but still have individuality in it, well, there's this huge potential for architectural educators and engineering educators and builders and developers and everyone in the whole production chain to think about what does that mean for this build, for this industry. Can I have integrated wall systems that have the plumbing, the wiring, the insulation, and the windows already there so they are plug and play? Can I have mechanical podiums that plug in and play? Can we think about a way of making sort of mass customization apply to the building industry? So part of that is an educational process that has to start early on with kids that are in design school. These 200,000 kids in China are probably going to learn a new way of designing. One of the things that if you as a professional are going to be competitive is really starting to rethink the process, because in rethinking the process, that's where there are huge gains to be made.
And we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but Karen, go ahead.
On this issue of addressing and educating people, I appeal to architects, if there are architects in the room, that if you strongly believe in this, it's our duty, for example, to go and speak out in forums. I've decided personally to give 30% of my time pro bono, and I have addressed over 5,000 architects in India, trying to inspire them to be green. And I think that is what we need to do, because this is, you know, I'm worried about this word accelerating. In India, accelerating is a problem. We are just going sometimes mindlessly. So I think one has to also be careful about too much acceleration.
I would add one point to the education chain, and that's don't forget about your children. The people in this room are very passionate about it, and I think we all as parents need to walk the talk, right, and give them the right values. One of the big oil companies is providing coloring books that address this issue to fourth graders, right? And so I think we need to think about that also. I was at a media panel in New York City where they had MTV and MySpace on the panel, and kids in that age group are clamoring for green content. I think we should give it to them and give it to them in the right format that's actionable and let them embrace it and make it their own. I think it's really important.
To the panel. And at this point, I would like to introduce President Jose Maria Figueres, who, as president of Costa Rica, created a comprehensive national sustainable development strategy combining sound macroeconomic indicators, strategic human development investments, and strong alliance with nature. I'm sure you're all familiar with this. Costa Rica is a beacon to many of us. President Figueres was the first person to be named CEO of the World Economic Forum, where he strengthened global corporate ties to social and governmental sectors by identifying common long-term interests. And as I'm sure you're well aware, the CGI has its roots in Bill Clinton's visits to Davos with his overlay of commitment. So today, Jose Maria Figueres continues to do work in the fields of technology and development and is currently CEO of the Grupo Felipe Cuatro, based in Spain, dedicated to supporting organizations which promote development and democratic values around the world. Please welcome President Figueres.
I think there's a difference of height here. Well, okay, whatever. We'll figure it out. Amigas y amigos, buenos días. Muchísimas gracias. Perhaps it's better if we continue in English. I have the enormous privilege, and I don't want to be in front of Bill here either. I have the enormous privilege of sharing with you some of the commitments that have been made over these days and that are going to be hereby recognized. I want to begin by recognizing, of course, our panelists, because I think this has just been a super, super, super session. And
And in spite of the connotations of the word acceleration, which I would fully agree with, I also have to say that when you talk about acceleration, it's because there's already a base there. Many of you, our panelists certainly, have been in this field of greening buildings for quite some time. But Bill, you started this off, if I can say so, back in 77. You mentioned 84, a first greening of a building here in the U.S. You were doing already this back in 77. You're the first greenhouse, the first green building, the first green roof. Thank you for your leadership. Yeah? So with Jessica Bailey here, we're going to go through the commitments that are being highlighted, and thank you for them. The first one, well, this team was brought together by Energy Positive with partners, the Rocky Mountain Institute, Oasis out of France, Constantini, and is making a $35 million commitment to creating the world's first 1 million square foot energy positive office building that produces 20% more energy than it uses. Great, great, great commitment. Can I please call on the Energy Positive team was inspired to do this at the mid-year meeting. They've been doing exploratory work since and felt ready to make this public commitment here at the annual meeting. And through their efforts, Energy Positive aims to inspire a pioneering series of major energy positive buildings around the world and help empower a new generation of building owners, tenants, and professionals to follow this path. So congratulations. Now let me call on you, because I should have called you at the beginning of this, but I just wanted to make Bill feel in company for what he did up here with the speakers a little while ago. No. Patrick Gottfried, Chairman of Energy Positive. Michael Kirchman, Associate Partner, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. And Jacques Roizen, Head of the Revenue Enhancement Group, Alvarez and Marcel.
Thank you so much.
Just, I want to say where the contribution is not 3.5 million, it's 35 million. So it's that's just an error.
Did I say 3.5?
Yeah, 3.5 million, 35 million.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Okay. $35 is certainly impressive. I'm sorry that I said 3.5, but in retrospect, probably better that I said 3.5 than 350. I don't know. Maybe we'll go to 350 next year. On to our second commitment. Let me invite to the stage Shelley Cohen, Senior Renewable Energy and Energy Efficient Project Developer of Ameresco, and Tasha McCauley, Co-Director, Mel and Bren Simon Foundation. Hey. Ameresco, Walmart, and the Mel and Bren Simon Foundation are undertaking an efficiency blitz, bringing together Ameresco efficiency experts, Walmart employee volunteers, and technical school students to make homes and school in the New Orleans healthier places to live, learn, and build a community. Over 3 days, teams will descend on the lower Ninth Ward to retrofit buildings, install better windows, insulation, and water-saving technologies. This blitz will help New Orleans homeowners who are struggling to get their lives back on track after Hurricane Katrina, delivering home and school improvements that lower energy bills. The Mel and Bren Simon Foundation are generously helping to underwrite this effort with a gift of $100,000. The total cost is $250,000. And if you want to come in and help, you're greatly encouraged to do so. Thank you so very much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Now let me call on Julia Marton Lefebvre, who is at this point in time Director General of IUCN, the World Conservation Union. I've had the privilege of working with Julia before in different environmental endeavors. And also let me call on Scott Hayost, Executive Director of IUCN here in the U.S. IUCN, a leading global network of conservation experts, is committed to construct one of the most environmentally friendly buildings in Europe, and possibly the world, by building a new international headquarters in Switzerland. The goal is to set a European benchmark by being the first building to reach both the highest Swiss green building standards and at the same time the highest U.S. based standard, LEED Platinum. Thank you, Julia, for this great effort. Now on to our fourth commitment. May I call Mark Woodall, CEO of Climate Change Capital. Hi, Mark. Climate Change Capital, one of the world's leading investment management companies for the low carbon economy, will develop and launch a UK-based $1 billion real estate fund that will invest in best practice design and construction of green buildings, including office, retail, and residential. The fund make a major contribution to demonstrate the economic and environmental benefits of developing and occupying low energy buildings. Thanks a lot. Before we close, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to take one last minute to ask a few more members to stand up wherever you are seated here with us and be recognized for your 2007 commitments, hoping that you will seek, that the rest of us will seek them out and hopefully join and participate with them in these commitments. Susan Tomasky. Susan, thank you. American Electric Power, represented today by Susan, has a commitment related to green building with a twist. AEP, serving 5 million customers in 11 states, will begin to green its 400 facilities with a special eye towards greening opportunities for industrial buildings. They will share what they learn with their customers and peers. Thanks a lot, Susan. Jim Croce of Next Energy, CEO of Next Energy, is partnering with Nextech Power Systems for a $200 million commitment to develop a cutting-edge urban eco-village in Detroit as an international model for urban renewal through sustainable technologies deployment. The Symbio Cycles Foundation is one of the funders, and they are looking for additional partners. Thank you very much. Rob Watson, right here. Rob Watson, co-founder of Edaberry Group, LLC, commits to a partnership with the City of Chicago to make the East Garfield Park a zero-carbon neighborhood. On November 6th, Chicago Mayor Daley will announce the Opal Prize, Opal standing for Organic Progressive Architecture and Land Use, a $1 million contest to produce a green master plan for East Garfield representing up to $100 million in LEED certified real estate development. Thanks a lot. And finally, Ted Keel. Thank you, Ted. Ted Keel, chairman of the Nurture Nature Foundation, working with Leslie Hoffman. Good. Executive director of Earth Pledge, has made a major commitment to create a center on environmental solutions at Pace University Law School that will help law students, lawyers, and companies to resolve environmental interest disputes that can only be resolved by voluntary consent. Congratulations and thank you for your leadership. This about wraps it up, amigas y amigos, and in doing so, I would just like to, in 30 seconds, recognize four people that, under the leadership of President Clinton, make this track on energy and climate change possible. They all have day jobs and obligations, and they all scratch minutes and hours away from the nth hour on every day to kind of work and pull this entire program together, which is a job that they do under John Needham's direction, but in a very consistent way throughout the year. So David Sandelow, which I'm sure you're going to be recognized by President Clinton, but David Sandelow, who is the leader of this job. He has a great book coming out in about 2 weeks called Freedom from Oil. Freedom from Oil. Good reading. With him, three co-directors of this track. Amy Christensen, which I've had the pleasure of working with for many, many years. Come on, Amy, stand up. PJ Simmons, First met PJ in Costa Rica many years ago with Tom Lovejoy, and Mark Terrell. Michael Terrell, I'm sorry, Michael. Back to you. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm John Needham, the CEO of the Clinton Global Initiative. Thank you to all of you for your great commitments. I also would like to thank our great friend, President Figueres, for the great job that he does, not just here, but all year round with us. Thank you, President Figueres. And I have just a schedule announcement to make, which is that the closing session with President Clinton will open at 2 o'clock and will go until 3:30. So it's a little different from what's on your schedule, but it's going to be great, and we look forward to seeing you all of you there. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, lunch is available outside the session rooms, and you may feel free.